From the KGOU studios, I'm Brian Hartzinski, filling in this week while Suzette Grelot is on her way to Italy. And welcome to Worldviews. Suzette Grelot does join me from Dallas to discuss the move for independence in a region of Spain, as well as political instability in Ukraine.
You know, we see a significant burden being taken on by the people living in that territory, and there are those just that aren't really interested in helping out.
Then our contributor Rebecca Cruz talks with Peter Lockery. He's the director of water for the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, or CARE. The organization got its start right after World War II, delivering food aid across Europe.
So care packages, in other words, you know, care package is actually a CARE's trademark, but it's passed into, common language now.
These conversations are coming up, but the news is next. This is Worldviews. I'm Brian Hartzinski, and a little bit of a role reversal today, coming out from behind the control room glass to talk with Suzette Grelot, who's joining me from Dallas. Suzette, I want to talk about this push for secession from Catalonia. It's a region of Spain that's growing increasingly frustrated with the government in Madrid. What are some of their issues? Why are they doing this, and what exactly is at stake here?
Well, Catalonia, of course, used to be independent until the 18th century and the creation of modern-day Spain. Now, Spain in 1977 did grant the region some autonomy, but rolled it back in 2006. And that's really when independence movements started heating up, increased interests and movements and protests, and then the economic crisis also fueled this movement later in the 2000s and into recent years. But really, since 2005, the independence movement in Catalonia has skyrocketed, going from about 13% in 2005 to its high to about 45% in 2014, support among the population. But it's declined a little bit in recent years, and perhaps that has something to do with economics as well, that and perhaps many immigrants that are moving into the region. So the motivation is that, you know, they used to be independent. They have their own language, their own culture, their own customs. But they also, I think, are embroiled in a lot of economic issues here and really just want to set themselves apart. They're a relatively wealthy part of Spain and don't necessarily like to be part of the Spanish economic decision-making that goes on in Madrid.
Earlier this year, there was a similar movement to set themselves apart in Scotland, and they actually voted against independence from the United Kingdom. Is there any parallel here? And how has this been perceived outside of Spain by the rest of the European community or even international players?
Well, I think the Scottish referendum, I think we can draw some parallels with what's going on in terms of Catalan nationalism, Scottish nationalism, very similar. And again, economic issues tended to strongly influence what was going on, at least in recent years. Again, Scotland, like Catalonia, some of the similar issues regarding, you know, differences in culture, customs, and even to some degree language. But at the end of the day, the Scottish voted against it, and we don't know what would happen in Catalonia. The support for Catalan nationalism is somewhat mixed. There are proponents and there are a number of opponents to it. But at the end of the day, economic interdependence is going to reign. The fact that this is a small country, even though it is wealthy, will still struggle to be an independent nation. The European Union is opposed to it. The United States is opposed to it. The UK is opposed to it. I mean, there are many major players out there that are opposed. Of course, Spain will, the government in Madrid will definitely resist. So I think that the jury is still out on this, despite the fact that the Catalan parliament has voted to start the process. I think we're a long way from actually seeing it happen.
I want to move from the western tip of Europe and Spain to the east, specifically in Ukraine, where there are about 3 million people that have been plagued with what the New York Times has described as a frozen zone. What exactly do they mean by that, and what's going on here?
Well, frozen, sometimes literally, given the weather in the region, but nonetheless, frozen politically, economically. Now, as we all know, there's been this war in eastern Ukraine. The pro-Russian separatists that now govern the region overtook about, the eastern part of Ukraine, about 3 million people living there in limbo. Now, neither Moscow nor Kiev seem to be all that interested in supporting. There is no patron, really, in this region. So a lot of homelessness and hopelessness. No kids are going to school. In fact, the young people have left the region, leaving largely the elderly to try to survive. Food is in short supply. So it's interesting to see how this has emerged in the strategic purpose of the region, which there really isn't much of one other than having that kind of frozen area that provides this buffer to Russia regarding the eastward expansion of NATO if the western part of Ukraine is to become a member of NATO. So, we see a significant burden being taken on by the people living in that territory. And there are those just that aren't really interested in helping out. And so we've got a long-term crisis that's brewing.
That's Suzette Grelot. She's the regular host of World Views. Suzette, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Brian.
If you have any thoughts or comments about this show, let us know in the Worldviews section of our website, kgou.org. You can also follow the show on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. I tweet at Brian Hardzinski, and Suzette tweets at Suzette Grelot. Coming up, our contributor Rebecca Cruz talks with Peter Lockery. He's the director of water for the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, or CARE. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and this is World Views. This is World Views. I'm Brian Hardzinski, filling in today for Suzette Grelot. Today we'll hear from environmental engineer Peter Lockery. He's the director of water for the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, or CARE. For the past two decades, he's expanded the organization's water team strategies and led efforts to promote sanitation and health in the developing world. Earlier this year, he was awarded the University of Oklahoma's International Water Prize, a $25,000 cash award given out every 2 years by OU's Water Technologies for Emerging Regions Center. Peter Lockery spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Peter Lockery, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
Well, you have played a significant role in an organization known as CARE. This is an international relief humanitarian aid organization. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about its history, its mission, perhaps how it's developed over the last 70 or so years, and what they're doing right now?
CARE, Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere. We are, as you said, an international non-governmental organization. And our overall mission is attacking global poverty. So we started CARE, but it was KUSA in those days, immediately after the Second World War, sending food parcels to Europe. So CARE packages, in other words, CARE packages actually a CARE's trademark, but it's passed into common language now. So, at the center of our work in those early days and continuing to this day has been around food and then distribution of food initially, but then moving into programs that focused on food security. And we now, one of our major focus areas is food and nutrition security. The other area that KUSA focuses on is sexual, reproductive, and maternal health. So we have those two key programs. And then we also work in development and humanitarian assistance. So we have sort of major operations going on at the moment in Turkey and Jordan, dealing with the refugee crisis, the Syrian and some Iraqi refugees. We've also expanded beyond food and nutrition security, sexual reproduction and maternal health into areas that are associated with those main thrusts. So, you know, water and sanitation, water for agriculture as far as water is concerned, which have strong links with, you know, for example, achieving food security. We also have significant programming in microfinance. We have a major program in Africa called Access Africa, which is which supports the setting up of village savings and loans associations, primarily women's groups. They then graduate to sort of more significant lending and investment.
Sounds like a very large reach and a lot of players involved. So the overarching organization then works with these smaller, like Care USA, Care Australia. Do they all have the same missions, or is it determinant on the interests of that particular country or the situation in that particular region?
We now have a global program strategy after sort of many years. We came together about 2 years ago and developed a care global program strategy and, you know, arranged for different members of the Federation to take the lead in different areas. And I talked about, you know, Care USA taking the lead in food and nutrition security with other members of the Federation, of course.
Well, it seems to make sense. These are issues that do not stay put. They're not bound by state borders. They, of course, are global issues, and so it will take a global effort to try to alleviate them. One of the ones that you mentioned, which I think is a huge issue, it's actually an issue here in Oklahoma as well, but obviously an international issue, is water scarcity or water cleanliness. What activities specifically are you or the CARE organization working on in that regard?
So we essentially work on what we call Water Plus, which is water sanitation and hygiene, but also has sort of elements of water resources and ecologically sustainable uses of water.
And I think one of the other areas that you seem to focus on, and you've mentioned it a little bit, is women's rights, if you will, in terms of healthcare. But we also know that women are disproportionately affected by unclean water and unclean sanitation. Some of this is culturally based. Some of this is perhaps biologically based. But can you maybe talk a little bit about that and what specific efforts are underway to help women, particularly in the global South?
Certainly. If we take water and sanitation, for example, it has its presence or not has significant impact on women. For example, in many countries, the job of collecting water falls to women and girls. Often men are not involved.
And they're often going long distances to collect this water, maybe unclean, maybe dangerous.
Exactly. So they often have to spend, you know, 4 hours a day is not untypical. And that uses energy. It uses time, which could be devoted to other work around the household, agricultural work, etc. It also opens them up to sexual harassment. And, there have been sort of cases of rape and so on their way back and forwards to collecting water. So from the security's perspective, it's a big issue. And add to that that in schools, for example, women have or girls have a much harder time when there are inadequate facilities, particularly when they get to puberty. There's nowhere for them to sort of manage their menses. So we have put a lot of effort in our work with schools into changing or improving facilities so there are washrooms so girls can, wash their cloths if they use cloths, or looking at ways in which you set up school health clubs that can advise girls when they're entering puberty, can provide sanitary pads on an emergency basis, etc. So a lot of work done in that respect.
That's Peter Lockery, the Director of Water for the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, or CARE. We'll hear more about how water and sanitation issues affect women in the developing world right after this short break. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Brian Hardzinski in the KGOU studios, filling in for Suzette Grelot while she's on her way to Italy. This half hour, we've been hearing from Peter Lockery from the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, where he serves as the Director of Water. When we left off, he described some of the safety and security issues women face in the developing world when it comes to water and sanitation. He's been speaking with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
What is the approach to dealing with these girls or some of the other projects that are in the global south? There's often been this criticism that the north is the ones, they have the resources, and so they go south and advocate for very worthwhile things, but don't always incorporate the cultural context or perhaps the realities on the ground. It sounds like this program that you're talking about here specifically has been quite successful. How have you gone about getting the buy-in at the local level that's so important?
Well, you are not working alone. You, of course, are working with government. You're also doing analysis and preferably working with, local governments or in some cases with central government. So you're working as a team to do the analysis, identify what the issues are, and making, agreements on what the changes in policy are that need to be put in place, how, the government budget needs to be adjusted to meet these requirements. So, we're not imposing. We are, working closely with government in many cases, both at local and national level, to identify the problems and figure out ways of overcoming them. So increasingly our work is not around service delivery, it's around analysis, research, and advocacy, done, of course, with our colleagues in the field, but also typically working with local and national government, as I said, but also with local academic institutions. So trying to get them involved in addressing some of the problems and barriers that are identified by, girls at school, their parents, ministries of education, local education authorities, etc.
So it sounds like a very important piece of the puzzle, getting the proper information, disseminating that information, the advocacy portion, not just the delivery.
Exactly. And actually, there's some sort of tension between service delivery and focusing on research and advocacy. The problem is that governments have a social compact with their populations to provide services. And if we as NGOs go in and start providing those services directly, A, we may be providing the wrong service.
Right.
And it may have unintended consequences. And secondly, we're undermining or we're letting government off the hook in a way. It's their responsibility. And so, yes, we're in the role of supporting and assisting them, advising them, but not doing their job for them.
And this advocacy goes even broader than that, goes international in some sense. I think water security, be it social security or national security, international security affected by water is one of the largest issues we now face as a global society, but it certainly is only going to increase. And it's really easy for us, perhaps in the North or in the West, to say that these are issues that are happening elsewhere, that these are not things that we need to be concerned about because they're not directly affecting us. How has your advocacy or information sharing attempted to convince everyone that these are global issues, that we should be paying attention to them?
Well, I don't think if you live in the United States, you can think that water is an issue that is not affecting us here, even in Oklahoma. I don't know so much about Oklahoma, but I know a lot about California, and I know quite a bit about
Georgia. It's affecting us here, but I do Georgia. Still hear this from people that, you know, these are dirty water and sanitation. Those are issues of the global south. Those are not issues of the global north, but these things affect us all.
Okay, so when you look at water security, for example, and you look at where the bulk of water is, it's not in the form of blue water, i.e. the water in rivers and streams and lakes and the groundwater. It's in the form of soil moisture. And the extent in to which soil can capture and retain soil moisture is dependent on the condition of the soil. So when you start looking at water security, you very quickly move into soil and water management, sort of landscape management approaches. And from some work that we've been doing in East Africa, we came up with the term water smart agriculture as a way of trying to advocate for the appropriate balance between the use of green water, the water in the soil, mm-hmm. and blue water for agriculture. The idea being that in many countries, the bulk of the food is actually being produced by smallholders, many of whom are women, and many of whom do not have access or are likely to have access to irrigation. So they're dependent on rain-fed agriculture. So the issue is around investing in rain-fed agriculture, improving the efficiency of rain-fed agriculture. So just in the way that we, a decade ago came up with this idea of if you invest in WASH, water sanitation and hygiene, then it will lead to the following benefits. Then we have also, in parallel, the idea is with water smart agriculture, invest in water smart agriculture. And we don't have time to go into all the details of what that means, but then it will lead to the following benefits. So basically what it's about is significantly improving the efficiency of rain-fed agriculture. And a lot of it has to do with how soils are managed to increase capture and infiltration rates and retention.
So as we move forward in trying to deal with this large issue, it sounds like it's going to take investment, imagination, and information, if you will. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Peter Lockery, the Director of Water for the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, or CARE. You can watch a video of him explaining a few misconceptions about water on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you'll also find an archive of our past shows and write-ups of the individual segments. Those were prepared by Ivy Dyson and myself, and this episode was produced by Sam Dupre. For Suzette Grelot and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Brian Hardzinski.